Welcome to the podcast of Media Matters with Bob McChesney, a weekly show on media from WILL Radio. Visit us at will.uiuc.edu.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. This is Bob McChesney, your host, coming to you live today on WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois. We have a terrific show for you today. We have one of the leading economic journalists and one of the really top public journalists, economists in the United States today joining us, talking about how the U.S. economy works today, the problems it's facing, and taking a long-term view over the last quarter century of the major changes in the U.S. political economy, political life, and looking forward to the future. So join us today for what should be a terrific hour program with Dean Baker. But first, before we go to Dean Baker, let's go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
In 2000, Congress authorized the FCC to issue low-power FM radio licenses to community groups and nonprofits. LPFM stations broadcast at 10 to 100 watts of power, covering about 3 to 5 miles. But when big media lobbyists complained that the tiny stations interfered with their full-power signals, Congress limited LPFM to rural areas. Thousands of applicants were prevented from getting licenses to bring community radio to their region. But a taxpayer-funded study found that big broadcasters' claims of interference were vastly overstated. And now bipartisan support is growing for bills in the House and Senate that would allow LPFM stations to go on the air in cities and suburbs across the country. Hannah Sassaman of the Prometheus Radio Project explains.
When Congress passed that law, they also asked the FCC to study whether or not low-power FM radio would truly interfere with full-power FM broadcasts in a big city like Philadelphia or D.C. or Boston. The FCC came back with an independent $2.2 million study which proved, beyond the shadow of a doubt, that there was plenty of room for real community radio. In Omaha, Nebraska, groups like the 100 Black Men of Omaha and people affiliated with the local YMCA wanted community radio to train kids on essential job skills and sharing their voices with people across the city. They joined together with Methodist church activists, local Chamber of Commerce officials, and thousands of community members to convince Lee Terry, the Republican from Omaha, to join with a great advocate of media reform, Mike Doyle, the Democrat from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, to introduce the Local Community Radio Act of 2007.
Low-power FM stations play a vital role in the community because they are so focused on local issues. People listen to it, and it can save lives. For instance, when Hurricane Katrina slammed into Mississippi, one of the handful of stations that continued to operate was WQRZ-LP.
The volunteers working at that station climbed their 130-foot tower to move their antenna and transmitter location to higher ground, and they kept on the air during the storm, and for the first 48 hours after the storm went through, they were the only link between all of Hancock County and the outside world.
This summer, LPFM activists will be visiting their representatives in their home states to urge them to support the Local Community Radio Act. Joe Torres, Government Relations Manager of Free Press.
We're doing in-district meetings with key members of the House Commerce Committee, which oversees telecom policy. We are asking constituents in the districts of about 20 representatives to actually take part in district meetings where they actually go and visit the congressperson, you know, asking them for their support for LPFM.
For more information, go to prometheusradio.org.
Mm-hmm. In New York City, the Mayor's Office of Film, Theater, and Broadcasting is redrafting a regulation that would have required photographers and filmmakers to get a permit and $1 million in liability insurance to shoot film and video in the city. The rules would have applied to any two people filming at a single site on public property for more than 30 minutes, or a crew of five or more people with a tripod filming on a site for more than 10 minutes. The onerous requirements would limit independent journalists and photographers, artists, tourists, and anyone interested in taking pictures in the most photographed city in the world. The mayor's proposed plan sparked a public outcry with an online petition that gathered more than 20,000 signatures, a First Amendment rally attended by 450 people, and even a rap video. The New York Civil Liberties Union threatened to file a lawsuit. Donna Lieberman, executive director of the NYCLU, said, "As with street demonstrations, people who are exercising their right to be on the sidewalk without interfering with pedestrian traffic should not be required under any circumstances to get government approval to take pictures." Catherine Oliver, the commissioner of the film office, said the rules will be revised based on the feedback the office has received, and a 30-day comment period will be opened after the new rules are published.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national, nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit www.freepress.net.
Okie dokie, welcome back to Media Matters. This is Bob McChesney, your host, coming to you live today on WILL AM 580 in beautiful, hot, summery Urbana, Illinois. Today we have a show that I've been looking forward to for a long time. Our guest is Dean Baker, the co-founder of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. Before founding the center, Dean Baker was a senior economist at Washington's Economic Policy Institute. He's written or edited several books, including one that's received a lot of attention over the years, which he wrote with Mark Weisbrot, Social Security, The Phony Crisis, published in 1999. Last year, he had a new book which he authored, The Conservative Nanny State, How the Wealthy Use the Government to Stay Rich and Get Richer. And then now he has a new book we'll be talking about during today's program, The United States Since 1980, published by Cambridge University Press. Always a pleasure to talk with you, Dean Baker. Welcome to Media Matters.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, you know, I have to say that I spent the last 3 days reading your book, The United States Since 1980, and I want to recommend it to people who really want to get a nice overview of the political economy of the United States for the past quarter century. And Dean Baker, you were really prescient in this book in many respects, because some of the issues you talked about in the book as problems for the economy since the book's been published have just jumped onto the front pages. Not only of the business sections, but of the newspapers and the lead news stories of the problems the economy is currently facing. And if anyone wants to get background on them, they should do two things. Read this book and listen to the show, because we're going to be talking about it today on Media Matters. First off, Dean, let's talk about your book that came out last year, because it's got such a great title, The Conservative Nanny State. What do you mean by that, and what's the basic argument of that book?
Well, I really want to beat up on sort of a conventional framing of political debates, which I think, unfortunately, a lot of liberals and progressives have accepted well, as well, that on the one hand, you have conservatives that want the free market, this idea of every person for themselves, you know, let us, you know, get the government out of it, you know, let us all, you know, run out, win or lose, and let the chips fall where they may. That's supposed to be a conservative view. And then on the one hand, you have liberals and progressives who are saying, no, we need the government. The government has to make sure that things come out okay, and that, you know, we help out those who manage to lose, and, you know, we're not going to go for this every person for themselves. And I think the framing's 100% wrong, both because I think it's bad politically. I think giving people the choice of, you know, what do you want? You want, you know, things left to themselves, or you want the government bureaucrat? You know, there's a prejudice, I think, on most people's part with some cause to say, well, why don't we leave things alone? I'm really not sure I want the government bureaucrat. But the other reason why I think it's a bad framing is it just doesn't capture the reality, because the reality is that there are all sorts of places, and this is what I try and document in the book, there's all sorts of places, it's not an exception, it's the norm, in which the government has set the rules to have income flow upwards. And what I try to do in the book is go through some of the most important, I won't say I cover all the ground, because there's way too much ground to cover, but some of the most important ways in which the government structures the market so that income will flow upwards. So that it's not a question that the conservatives want the market and progressives want the government. We both want the government. We want the government to intervene in the market. The point is we want the government to do different things. They want the conservative nanny state. They want the government to come in there and structure things so that Bill Gates and the hedge fund people, all the very wealthy, stay on top and make lots of money, whereas most progressives, you know, our view is that we want to make sure that we get decent economic outcomes so that the population, most of the population, has a decent standard of living. They have basic health care, housing, you know, what we think of as basic needs. So it's not market versus government. It's simply what we want the government to do. We both want the government. We both want the market. We just want it to go different places.
Dean Baker, give one or two examples of egregious examples of how the conservative nanny state works, how it isn't the free market, but in fact it's government policy, very conscious policy, that assists wealthy and conservative interests.
Let me take a couple big ones. Copyrights and patents. We know that these are mechanisms to provide incentives for innovation, for creative works. But they're government-guaranteed monopolies. They're government-granted monopolies. They're not the free market. In the free market, you know, I can make copies of Windows. I could, you know, if you want to buy a copy of Windows from me, or I don't know why you'd buy it because you can get it free off the web, you know, you're free to do so. You know, we could, anyone could share Windows with anyone they like. Same with prescription drugs, hugely important issue both in the U.S. and around the world. Anyone who wants to make, you know, the latest AIDS drug, you know, they go in their bathtub or ideally somewhere better and safer, but if they want to make the AIDS drug and sell it to whoever wants to buy it, they could do that. You know, if we have safety standards, you know, fine. But the point is Pfizer doesn't have a monopoly or Novartis doesn't have a monopoly on it. What the government does is it says, no, Bill Gates has a monopoly on Windows. We're going to arrest anyone. You know, we'll arrest anyone that makes a copy of Windows without Bill Gates' permission. And in the case of patented drugs, we're going to arrest anyone that makes copies of AIDS drugs without Pfizer and Novartis' permission. And as a result of this, there's enormous economic distortions created. You know, economists usually like to see things sell at their marginal cost. What was it cost to produce them? And in the case of Windows, basically free. Once it's there, you know, everyone in the world could have a copy at pretty much no cost. And in the case of, you know, most drugs, the vast majority of drugs can be sold as generics for a few bucks a prescription. But instead, we have drugs selling for hundreds, sometimes thousands of dollars a prescription because people need them for their health or their life. And, you know, Pfizer is a monopoly. And if anyone else makes it, they're going to jail. So that's an incredibly inefficient form of government intervention. I understand how we have to provide incentives, and I talk about that. They're alternative mechanisms. But the point is that we've created a government intervention in the economy that the conservatives portray. This is just natural, like, you know, this came down from God, that we're going to have copyrights and patents, you know. But the reality is it's a government monopoly, and it's an extremely inefficient one, but it also has the effect of redistributing income upwards. The other one, just sort of a very, very basic rules of the game story, corporations. Where do corporations come from? Again, to hear it from the conservatives, you'd almost think that, you know, somewhere in, you know, the 10th commandment, it says, or 11th commandment, there it is, there will be corporations. You know, no, corporations are created by the government. The government gives corporations all sorts of privileges. Most importantly, it gives corporations the privilege of limited liability so that you could have an asbestos company that gives, you know, exposes hundreds of thousands of people to asbestos, and it turns out they can't cover the damage. Well, asbestos company's out of business, end of story. All the people who are running the asbestos company, the shareholders that might have made a lot of money, the top executives that might have made a lot of money, they're home free. They're fine. That's not their problem. You know, all the people who are suffering from asbestosis, it's their problem. Well, that's a government intervention. You know, I'm not arguing against corporations. I think there's a lot of reason why it's a good idea that the government allows people to create corporations. But the point is that's a creation of the government. That's not a free market. So it's certainly reasonable, for example, for us to put restrictions on corporations, and certainly reasonable for us to tax them, which is something that many of the conservatives now, you know, consider this gross injustice. But, you know, there's a long, long, long list of things. But what's interesting, and my reason for picking those two examples, is that so many people have come to think of these things as just being natural, that corporations are just natural, that copyrights and patents are just natural. They might be good policies, but they're certainly not natural. They're government policies. And we have to recognize that as government policies, you know, we can alter them. We could change them. They're not something that was just given to us. They're creations of the government.
This is Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We're coming to you live today on WILL AM 580. Our guest on the phone line, Dean Baker, the economist and the author of a couple of brand new books, the one we've just been talking about, The Conservative Nanny State, How the Wealthy Use the Government to Stay Rich and Get Richer, which came out last year, and then the brand new book, The United States Since 1980, which just came out this year, with Cambridge University Press. If you'd like to call in with questions or comments for Dean Baker, the number here at Media Matters is 333-9455. That's 333-9455, the toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Now, as I said, I've read the United States since 1980, just the last few days, and I liked it so much I'm planning to use it in my large undergraduate class, Dean.
Oh, great. I appreciate that.
I think your publisher will, too.
Yeah, absolutely.
You have an argument here. First of all, why did you pick 1980? What was it about 1980 that you saw as the beginning or ending or as a turning point in recent American history?
Yeah, actually, let me answer that in a moment, but I just want to go back to the conservative nanny state, because you will make my publisher very happy by using the book in your class. But I should mention, with the conservative nanny state, people could download that for free off the website. That's at www.conservativenannystate.org. So anyone who's interested could download the whole book, download a chapter, read online, whatever you like. Now, as far as picking 1980, well, two things I should say. One is they picked that for me. They were actually, Cambridge University Press is actually doing a series of books on different countries since 1980. So they picked that year. But frankly, I would have picked the year myself if they said, why don't you do a book on recent U.S. history? I would have picked that year just because it is such a turning point, because you do have the election of Reagan, and it's not that, you know, everything suddenly changed with Reagan, but I think it really crystallized things that were fermenting. So you had sort of a general move towards, I would say, a expanded welfare state in the United States through the post-war period, which really, you know, hit its peak in the Johnson era, of course, where you had, you know, the creation of Medicare, Medicaid, Head Start. You know, you really had an expansion of a number of programs. And 1980, you know, looking back, it's easy to forget how things were in 1980. You know, back then, the idea that we were going to have universal medical care, you know, I think many of us, if not most of us, sort of thought it was just a matter of time. I mean, you look to Europe, and all the European countries already had it longstanding. And, you know, at that time, there were a number of things being floated around. You know, Medicare, of course, meant that, and, you know, at that point, Medicare is a fairly new program. It's only been around 14 years, you know, so it's a fairly new program. So now we have health care for old people. We have Medicaid providing health care for, you know, poorer people. So the idea that, you know, we're going to add the additional step, we're going to get health care for everyone, that didn't seem far out, you know. So you could see that whole period through the 70s is a period where the welfare state in sort of a general sense advancing, the idea that, you know, the economy's growing. As a result of that, that means we could provide more benefits for the population, do more to ensure a decent standard of living for everyone. Also, in terms of wages, we had a very, very rough spell in the 70s because of the OPEC price increases, some other factors not worth going into just now. But in general, you know, income was being relatively evenly shared. The late 70s were a bad period for the economy, but they didn't stand out as being a bad period for typical workers. Everything changes in 1980, and Reagan's election symbolizes that, and it certainly contributed to it. So I don't mean to say he was everything, but things really crystallized in 1980 with the election of Reagan. So from that point forward, you see a serious weakening of labor unions, a deliberate rolling back, explicit rolling back of the welfare state. I mean, Reagan stated that as policy, so it's not like we have to attribute bad motives to him and it's under the table. It's quite explicit. He said, we want to roll back the welfare state. Government's the problem. We've got to roll it back. So that was quite explicit. Big tax cuts for people at the top end, very explicit. And internationally, a much more militaristic foreign policy. I don't want to glorify, you know, the pre-1980 foreign policy. One could point to all sorts of things we did in the world that weren't very good, but Reagan quite explicitly ran and implemented a much more militaristic foreign policy. So in a variety of ways, 80 really is a sharp break with what went before.
Now, Dean Baker, when a lot of the stuff you just spoke about, and certainly in the book you write about economic trends in the United States starting around 1980 that have gone through today, are trends that are oftentimes attributed to the entire world, what's called neoliberalism or the turn towards what others have called, certainly not you, free market economics. And you argue in the book, though, and I think it's very provocative, that in fact that's inaccurate, that in many respects it's the United States going in a very different path from the rest of the world.
Absolutely. I mean, if you look at what's happened in, you know, particularly Europe as the main place of contrast, you know, the U.S. really did pull apart from Europe in 1980. So, you know, what you could see prior to 1980, or at least I frame it this way, is that to that point, the United States was sort of a laggard in building up a welfare state, following in the path of Europe, behind it, but more or less in the same general direction. 1980, suddenly we go, no, no, we don't want unions, you know, and one of the measures, one of the things that Reagan did, well, I should say two things that he did, was he adopted an openly hostile stance to unions, which manifested itself on the one hand with the firing of the air traffic controllers when the air traffic controllers went on strike in 1981. Huge break with the past. You know, respectable employers didn't fire workers when they went on strike. Now, there was a legal issue there. Reagan could say, I'm legally in the right. That was true. He had the legal right to do that. But the fact was that just didn't happen previously. Hugely important, though, anti-union measure meant when people went on strike, they risked losing their job. The other thing was that He changed basically enforcement procedures at the National Labor Relations Board by allowing a huge backlog to develop so that it pretty much became a toothless tiger. What would happen is a company would fire a worker for trying to organize a union, totally against the law, but it might take 2 years for it to go through the process. So it made it kind of a joke. So it's a hugely anti-union measure, and that hugely weakened the power of unions, which, of course, were a main support of the social democratic policies that, you know, that we talk about in the book, Now, in Europe, this really didn't happen in the same sort of way. So in the United States, you know, along with the weakening of unions, the weakening of the welfare state, and the upward redistribution of income that we saw over the last quarter century, in Europe, you know, there were efforts to do this, but they, you know, and certainly plenty of people in Europe would like to follow in the U.S. path, but you really don't see this in anywhere near the same way. To some extent, you had Margaret Thatcher in England implementing similar policies, but she really didn't get anywhere near as far. I mean, England still has, you know, a very good national health care system, probably not as good as it was 25 years ago in many ways, but it still, you know, still provides very good health care for most of its population. They still have very strong unions, not as strong as they were 25 years ago, but a lot stronger than the U.S. And then if you look at continental Europe, you still have unionization rates across the continent that are way higher than the U.S., and, you know, in the extreme cases, the Nordic countries, you have unionization rates of 80%. So there's been very little rolling back of the welfare state, little bits here and there, but they still have health care everywhere. They still have relatively generous state-provided pensions everywhere. They have 5 weeks of vacation everywhere. And they haven't had this trend towards increasing inequality that we see in the U.S., England being an exception. That shares in that movement. But across Europe, there really has been very little change, very little movement towards growing inequality over the last quarter century.
Dean Baker, our guest today in Media Matters, author of the brand new book, The United States Since 1980. Dean Baker, an economist and a journalist who writes on matters about the economy, how they affect people. This book also is a political economy. In the book, Dean Baker goes through all the major elections, the debates on them, and really does a very nice job of linking political and economic developments very closely. The book is just out from Cambridge University Press. The phone lines here, if you'd like to talk to Dean Baker, 1-800-222-9455 is our toll-free line, local line 333-9455. Before we get to the phone lines, and I will get there in 1 second, so please be patient. Dean, I do want to follow up on this about the politics of these developments in the United States versus other countries. You just mentioned the decline of the welfare state, the increase of inequality, the lessening of the role of unions in the United States compared to other Western industrial nations. What about the Democratic Party? I mean, they're traditionally the party of the Great Society, of the New Deal, the party that represents the people getting messed with in your scenario. Have they been leading the fight to go the other direction? How have they fit into the scenario? Has this been a Republican ascendant story? What role have the Democrats played?
Well, the Democrats have gone along with this to a large extent. And, you know, we continue to see ongoing battles within the Democratic Party, so I wouldn't say it's a uniform pattern, but you've had a lot of acceptance on the part of the Democrats in this trend. Part of this goes to, you know, who are the Democrats? You know, if you go back to the 70s, the Democrats were hugely, I shouldn't say hugely indebted, but the labor movement was very, very strong within the Democratic Party, you know, right very much, you know, at the core of the party. You still have big city bosses, you know, which, you know, may have been corrupt in many ways, but, you know, nonetheless, these were sort of a working class influence, at least an influence that was to some extent independent of large corporate interest. That really changes over this period. And, you know, you take a look at the reporting these days on the Democratic presidential nomination. We're hearing, you know, about how Hillary Clinton has raised, you know, I think we're at $60 million now and, you know, something comparable for Barack Obama. They're not getting that from poor people. You know, there might be some poor people, middle-income people are contributing, but you don't raise, you know, $40, $50, $60 million from, you know, people sending you $100 contributions. That could help, but you need the people, you know, the really wealthy people. And the Democrats really have, to a large extent, gone at least halfway on these measures. And, you know, I think Bill Clinton's presidency really captures that. I mean, again, he quite explicitly ran as a new type of Democrat, a pro-business Democrat. When he came into office, you know, one of his biggest and first agenda items was NAFTA, which, you know, I think you could exaggerate the importance of NAFTA. I won't say, you know, that wrecked the economy, but it was symbolic of what he was trying to do in his trade agenda. And that was first and foremost put U.S. workers in direct competition with low-wage workers in the developing world, which has the predictable impact of lowering wages, you know, costing jobs for U.S. manufacturing workers. So that's, you know, that's a different sort of story than what we had from the Democratic Party pre-1980. And again, I don't mean to, you know, just throw names at Democrats, because clearly it's an ongoing battle. You have all sorts of people. You have people like Sherrod Brown in the Democratic Party, Dennis Kucinich, you know, who I think come from a very different angle. But nonetheless, when you look at the national leadership, you look at, who, you know, President Clinton and the likely people who are going to end up as a presidential nominee in 08, I think you see a much more pro-business party than would have been true, say, back in the 60s.
It's interesting, in the new edition of The Economist magazine, the Business Weekly magazine based out of England, they have a discussion of how well the Democrats are doing and how it's likely that they will win a landslide in 2008, not because of their popularity as much as the unpopularity of the Bush administration and the Republican Party. And in the piece, The Economist more or less assures its readers not to worry, that it says Hillary Clinton's political views on every single major issue are to the right of any leading conservative in leading a conservative party in England, Sarkozy or Merkel in France and Germany. So more or less holding to your thesis.
Yeah, and it's, you know, from the vantage point of someone who wants to see progressive change, it's somewhat disappointing if, you know, the prospect is having, you know, a Republican who certainly is not going to be a supporter of progressive change and a Democrat who, you know, is not going to be a hell of a lot more supportive. You know, we think back to 1992, and I remember having discussions with people going, well, one thing we could think is going to come of this election, at least we're going to get national health care insurance. Maybe not our ideal plan, but, you know, we'll get something. And, you know, I mean, I think the Clinton administration did try to do it, but they managed to flub it. But the remarkable thing was, as a result of flubbing it, they managed to knock it off the agenda for 15 years. Not something I would have imagined, but, you know, you would hope that at least at this point you could sort of realistically say, okay, well, if a Democrat gets in the White House, we're going to have national health care insurance. And, you know, I don't think anyone could look at the, you know, the candidates, and particularly Senator Clinton is certainly the favorite at this point, and say that, oh, yes, if a Democrat wins, we're going to get national health care insurance. That can't be taken for granted.
Our guest, Dean Baker, author of the new book, The United States Since 1980. You're listening to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, and WILL AM 580. Let's go to the phone lines now to some long, patient callers. Let's start with line four in Farina. Farina, you're on the air with Dean Baker.
Hi, thanks a lot. Three things I'm curious about from your guest. Nixon delinked the gold standard from the currency. If you could comment on that, was that a good thing or a bad thing? I never quite figured that one out. But I know Nixon. I just always anyway. The other thing is the savings and loan scandal in the Reagan years. Are there parallels with this lending crisis now, or, you know, people that think Reagan was such a good president seem to overlook the really bad things that happened during his presidency? And the last thing is, how much influence does OPEC and the oil producers have over our economy? If you could quickly comment on some of those things. Thanks a lot.
Well, thank you, friend. And Dean, before you answer, Dean Baker, let me just say to our listeners that we are very fortunate of Dean Baker, because while an economist, he has a good ability to explain these sorts of issues to a lay audience. And Dean, we most certainly have a lay audience.
Okay, well, I'll try and keep this simple and straightforward. Let me take one and three first. One was the question, Nixon delinked the dollar from gold in 73. Was that a good or bad thing? I'd say it was a necessary thing. Without getting into too much detail, we had sort of a rigid link of the dollar to gold coming out of World War II, and that was really with the dollar as the world's sort of benchpin currency. And the problem was that the dollar was overvalued, and when we wanted to change the value of the dollar, we had to negotiate with basically all the countries in the world, say, okay, you will revalue your currency against the dollar. It was not an easy process, And, you know, it was probably a good idea to do as Nixon did, to de-link it from gold.
Can I stop you right there, Dean? Because we hear this, in a dollar is overvalued, or currency is overvalued or undervalued. What does that mean? How does that manifest itself? Why does that affect us?
Well, the simplest way to think of it, you know, at least my measure of being undervalued or overvalued, is do we have a trade deficit? And if you have a trade deficit, I would say that's sort of prima facie reason to believe your currency is overvalued. The reason why you would get a trade deficit is imports are too cheap and your exports are too expensive to everyone elsewhere in the world. And the dollar is what determines how cheap imports are and how expensive our exports are. So if the dollar falls, just to take the crudest example, if the dollar falls by 20%, other things equal, and other things will never be exactly equal, but let's say nothing else in the world changes, if the dollar falls by 20% against the euro and the yen and the Chinese currency on down the list, then everything we buy from those countries suddenly costs us 20% more. So presumably we'll buy less of it. Conversely, when we look to sell, you know, our wheat and everything else we might sell that's produced in the United States, it's going to cost 20% less to people living in Europe and China and Japan and everywhere else in the world. So when the dollar falls in value, we export more, we import less, we move towards balanced trade. And we don't have to have exactly balanced trade, but there's a limit to how large and how long you could run a very big deficit for. And today we're currently running a very big deficit. We were in that boat in the 70s also, not nearly as bad as we are today. But that was the reason why Nixon delinked to gold in 73. And the problem we face today is that we have a very large trade deficit because the dollar is overvalued.
Okay.
Well, okay, the other questions. OPEC. I wouldn't say that OPEC has all that much influence in the sense that, you know, they do try to restrict their output when they perceive oil prices as falling, but it's a very loose cartel, so it's not as though they all sit down and they say, okay, we're going to cut back our production by 10%, and then everyone does that. They say that, and there's cheating, and maybe there'll be some reduction. Some of the members do reduce their production. Others just go back and say, okay, well, fine, you all said that, we're going to ignore it. So I'd say OPEC has a limited impact, but really it's not that much, and if it didn't exist, if, you know, we could snap our fingers and there were no coordination between the major oil producers, I really doubt prices would be all that different, particularly today when most of the OPEC countries are producing pretty much what they're capable of doing it. So if they, you know, weren't trying to restrict their output at all, I don't think you'd see much additional output on oil on world markets.
Now, before you get to that last part on the savings loan, let me sort of adjust the question slightly, if I can, to relate it to the themes of your book. My sense is that since the 1970s, debt, the financial sector, banks, are playing a much larger role in the U.S. economy than they did prior to the 1970s, that this has been a real emerging storyline of our economy. And with that all comes all sorts of traditional problems, speculation, booms and busts. And then maybe you could just talk a little about that and put the S&L crisis of the 1980s in that context.
Yeah, you know, debt has exploded. And, you know, it's interesting. This is a classic case, talking about the nanny state, because you have sort of intermediate regulation. You know, they'll say that all these people are talking about deregulation. We don't have a completely deregulated market. We have a partially deregulated market, which in a lot of ways is the worst of all worlds. So it leads to a lot of really bad practices. And the S&Ls probably are the best example one could ever think of in this way, because what happened with the S&Ls, basically S&Ls were a somewhat antiquated institution in the 70s in the sense that they were very tightly regulated. They could only lend or mostly lend their money for residential housing. And, in fact, they even were regulated on what they could pay by way of interest. So in the high inflation 70s, all these S&Ls lost a huge amount of money because they had lent money on mortgages. At that time, a normal mortgage interest rate, actually we came back to this, was about 6%. But to get money into the bank, to get people to deposit money, they had to pay 8%, 9%, even 10% interest. So if you've lent at 6 and you're borrowing at 10, you know, you're in real trouble. And that's where the S&Ls were. But they were guaranteed. They were guaranteed by the government so that, you know, if I put money in S&L, I knew I didn't have to worry because the government was, you know, they were going to bail me out. And if it turned out the S&L was bankrupt, not my problem. Well, when Carter was leaving office, they were making plans to shut down large numbers of S&Ls because they were bankrupt. He didn't have a chance to finish that. It's a long process. They had to, you know, work this out. How do you close down thousands of SNLs? Because, well, that's what you're talking about, probably most of the industry. Reagan came in and said, oh, that's crazy. You know, they have cash in the vaults. They don't have to shut down. Why don't we let them work their way out of it? And this is classic, like, bad regulatory practice, because they still had this guarantee. They tell the SNLs that are bankrupt, so they have nothing to lose, go and work your way out of it, and then they take off all the regulations. So before, 90% of their loans had to be to residential housing. They said, do whatever you want. So you had some of them, you know, just making bad judgment but in good faith, some of them just committing outright fraud because they had nothing to lose. I'm going to go ahead and, you know, lend this developer, you know, $100 million with this crazy scheme, which may blow up in his face, but if it does, who cares? I'm not losing anything. We're already bankrupt, you know, and if it pays off, you know, great, you know, we're golden. And that's exactly what happened. So you took what would have been a minor hit to the government and made it a much bigger one, because these SNLs did exactly what you expected them to do. They took really big risks because they had nothing to lose, and the depositors went ahead and put money in the SNLs because they had nothing to lose. The government's guaranteeing their money.
And the extent of this scandal was just absolutely immense, wasn't it?
It was huge. I mean, we ended up, the cost was estimated at $140 billion. This was back in, you know, about 1989 or 90. So, you know, probably multiply that by about 1.6. So you're talking about, you know, perhaps, you know, somewhere around $250, $260 billion in today's dollars.
You could invade a mid-sized country and occupy it for that sort of money.
Yeah, at least for a few years, you know. So, and as I say, it was totally predictable, totally preventable. Now, how does that fit in with today's, what was going on today? Well, part of the story of what is going on today is that you have mortgage issuers that are issuing mortgages that have no concern at all for whether these mortgages will ever be paid back, because they know they will dump them in the secondary mortgage market where they'll never have to see them again. This is first and foremost the subprime story, where they issued these deceptive mortgages that had teaser rates. You know, you get the mortgage today and you only pay 2 or 3% interest. Many of them said that. But then they reset in 2 years or 3 years, and then you might be paying 6, 7, 8%, which, of course, a lot of people wouldn't be able to pay. And the issuers knew that. But they didn't care, because there's a secondary mortgage market where they could just dump it and it will go bad in the hands of people in the secondary mortgage market. Now, who are those people? Well, we're finding out now. It turns out a lot of French banks were in there. You know, they had their hedge funds. Apparently, the Chinese had invested a lot in the secondary mortgage market. You had a lot of people that had no idea what they were doing, I'm sure, buying up large amounts of debt in the secondary mortgage market. So, again, it's a sort of partial deregulation where, you know, I'm sure these people holding the debt in the secondary mortgage market thought that it was much more secure, probably thought there was government guarantees on it, because if they're backed by Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, in effect there is a government guarantee on it. But now they're finding that, you know, in fact they held very, very risky assets. So what you have is a situation where it didn't really benefit the borrowers, because they're going to lose their homes. It didn't, at the end of the day, it's probably going to end up hurting a lot of the investors. The intermediaries, on the other hand, will do very well.
Now, Dean Baker, you argue in your new book, The United States Since 1980, and in your popular writings that I'm familiar with, that, you know, the economy of the last several years has been kept afloat by the massive trade deficit, which, as you argue, and you've already stated here, is not sustainable and very quickly at a point where it can no longer be continued, where we can live well beyond our means, and also by the buoyant real estate prices, the residential real estate well in excess of any historical level compared to the rest of the economy over the last 5 or 10 years. And now we see that's coming tumbling down fairly quickly. You predict both these things and lay them out in your book, I think, quite well. Where are we going with this economy? What are the options facing us in the coming year to 3 years as you see it? And since you really come with a pretty high batting average, frankly.
Yeah, well, I may have a high batting average, but I think it's more because everyone else, the other economists at least, seem to do their best to avoid looking at what's in front of their face, you know. And I can go back to the stock bubble when, you know, to me it seemed pretty evident. Yeah, stock bubble, you just look at stock prices, you look at where corporate profits were, and it didn't make sense. But, you know, economists, for whatever reason, would refuse to look at that. And today it's the exact same thing with the housing market. You know, to me the fundamentals were, you know, what has been the long-term trend in house prices. And suddenly you get this big run-up in 95 that had no historical precedent. And, you know, I had occasion to debate an awful lot of people on this. I just go, what happened in 1995 that was different from 85, 75, 65? There's an economist, Robert Shiller, a very good economist at Yale University, who wrote a book, Rational Exuberance. He talked about the stock bubble also. And he went back to 1895, and he doesn't find, you know, any trend where you get this sort of jump up in house prices like what we had in, since 95. So, you know, basically, I looked at this, that we have a housing bubble, which will collapse for the same reason bubbles always collapse. You get an oversupply of housing, and that's what we have now. We have the inventory of unsold homes is 50% higher than it's ever been. Vacant ownership units is 100% higher than it's ever been. You know, so you will see a very big fall in house prices. You will almost certainly see, you know, a huge downturn in construction, but also a downturn in consumption because people have been borrowing against their homes. They've been doing that at a very, very rapid pace. So I almost certainly think we will see a recession. We will probably see a large fall in the dollar going along with this because, you know, exactly what I was talking about a moment ago, it turns out that, surprise, surprise, a lot of people in France were investing in the subprime mortgages. And it turns out people in China also, well, they're not going to keep doing it. Most people don't invest to lose money. So, you know, they're gonna cut back their loans to the United States. That probably will mean a fall in the dollar, which is something that has to happen. But in the short term, what that's going to mean is higher inflation. So I think we're going to likely see, you know, a very, very rough stretch over the next year, 2 years, 3 years, possibly longer, depending on how good the policy is, in which on the one hand we see a collapse in house prices, you know, bankruptcies hitting widely, so a lot of the people will find out exactly who are speculating in mortgage-backed securities end up going bankrupt. We're going to see inflation because the dollar will fall. That will mean higher import prices. In the longer term, in principle, this could set the basis for, you know, solid economic growth of what we used to have, where you had, you know, rising wages leading to rising consumption, leading to more investment, rising wages, you know, the virtuous circle that we used to talk about in the 50s and 60s. How long that takes, do we get there? That will depend on the policies we pursue. But the immediate future, I think, looks very, very bad.
We have three callers very patiently waiting. I want to get to them in a second, but I do want to do one follow-up on this point, if I can, Dean Baker. You know, if any other country in the world, I think, with almost without exception, were to spend $1 billion out of, or $1 trillion out of its economy over a 5 or 10 year period to invade another nation and occupy it, it would do serious damage to the ability of that country to maintain its standard of living. It would be such a drain on its resources. The United States is now in the process of doing that in Iraq. Is that having any negative effect on our economy? Or are we such a wealthy economy that we can sort of do the invade countries and spend $1 trillion over 5 years or whatever it is, and it doesn't really affect us negatively? It only has a positive effect of stimulating, you know, war production.
Well, I think the effect to date has probably been fairly limited. It might have actually been positive if you go back to the early years, 2003, 2004, when the economy was still quite weak. But what's likely to happen is we will start to feel a cost. I mean, basically, we haven't felt the cost at all because we've been borrowing. You know, basically, you know, China and, you know, the other countries have been financing the war.
That's what I mean, then. If we're borrowing because of the war, then we do, that is a cost we face.
Oh, it is, but we don't see that right now.
Yeah.
We'll see that when the dollar starts to fall and we suddenly start to pay much, much higher prices for imported goods and possibly are facing considerably higher interest in the United States. At that point, we will feel the cost. But to date, you know, if you try to say, okay, how much has this realistically affected the economy, you know, I'd say the effect has probably been small in net. And, you know, if I had to put a sign on it, has it been positive or negative, maybe a small positive.
Our guest, Dean Baker, author of the new book, The United States Since 1980. Dean Baker, one of the leading popular economists. And I say popular not to mean his work is not rigorous, but rather that he writes about the political implications of economics and the political choices we face as citizens that really connects with the concerns that all of us have, as I'm sure you've all recognized this hour. Let's go back to the phone lines. The people have been very patient. Now to line one, Champaign County. You're on the air with Dean Baker.
Hi. On that last point, though, you didn't mention what they call opportunity costs. What could that borrowing have built in this country, such as rehabilitating bridges and things like that?
Yeah, good point.
Okay. I wanted to go back to this liquidity crisis, quote-unquote. In the night, in my insomnia, I heard a report from the BBC, I think, about some semi-official think tank and economists suggesting that if the keeps twisting the arms of the Chinese to do something about the valuation of the yuan, that why don't we just stop buying so many dollars and diversify our buying? And it seemed to me that that, along with the French bank, could have... But I don't hear any commentary on that. I know you do... I think you're still doing the review of the papers of record and their business pages and debunking and pointing out the flaws in the arguments, et cetera. Yep. I'd like for you to... speculate on how important that would have been, even though it didn't really come up in any of the popular commentary. I mean, it's the borrowing from the Chinese is a constant theme in a way. They're financing the war, as was just said. I don't know if there's a lineup of callers, but I'd always like to hear something about, you know, Humphrey Hawkins and the whole idea that inflation is not as bad for the working class people as, you know, just sort of turn the tables on the discussion and point out how many of the commonplaces of business discussion just, you know, are totally vested in where you're sitting, whether you're an owner of capital or a borrower. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, caller. And I know there's a lot there for you to answer, Dean. But if you, and of course, the answer is that last part of the question, something I really want you to talk about too, which is your assessment of the caliber of reporting on the economy for the American people in the news media. What are the biases there? What are they missing? What part of the story is being distorted?
Okay, quickly taking the first part and then coming back to that. China has been financing, you know, a huge part of our trade deficit. Basically, they're both cause and effect in the sense that we have the trade deficit because the dollar is very high, in particular against the Chinese currency. So you get members of Congress who are yelling, we want you to raise the value of your currency. I should point out, we could also lower the value of ours. I mean, we can do that unilaterally if we like. I think for the most part, most of the members of Congress who are yelling that are kind of just doing this for symbolic purposes, political purposes. We do have to get the value of the dollar down, but they're scared to do that because it does mean that we'll have higher inflation, and that's why the Chinese sort of at the end of the day threaten and go, okay, you want us to do that, and that gets everyone running. Now, in terms of the Humphrey Hawkins, yeah, I'm very glad the caller brought that up because the Humphrey Hawkins Bill Act, I should say, which was, I think, dates to 76, the mid-70s, if it wasn't actually 76, it's the law that governs the running of the Federal Reserve Board. And it actually says the Federal Reserve Board is responsible for maintaining price stability and targeting full employment, which it defines as 4% unemployment. And this is, again, another, you know, sort of conservative nanny state institution because the Federal Reserve Board is very mysterious to a lot of people. And, you know, when Alan Greenspan was there, you know, everyone thought he was a great guy and he was the one who made sure the economy worked right. But one of the things it does or has done is it's raised interest rates to quite deliberately slow the economy when it felt the unemployment rate was getting too low. And through the 80s up to the mid-90s, what they did was every time the unemployment rate started to get below 6%, they would raise interest rates to slow the economy, keep people from getting jobs. And I say that to people and they think I'm being conspiratorial, but that is exactly what they intended to do because the belief that people at the Federal Reserve Board had was if the unemployment rate fell too far below 6%, that workers would be in a better position to bid up their wages, which is, of course, true, and that would lead to higher inflation, which turned out, you know, because Alan Greenspan tested this, to his credit, in the late mid-90s, it turned out not to be true. So in the mid-90s, the unemployment rate started to fall, and we eventually got down to 4% unemployment in the year 2000, and there was very little inflation to speak of. But the way the media talks about this is that they don't put this as a political issue. They just make it sound like, you know, the Fed is just this purely neutral institution, and they're sitting there and they decide the economy's overheating. They often use that term, you know, or terms similar to that, but often literally the term overheating. So they're raising interest rates. And very few people understand, I know this from having talked to a lot of people, very few people understand that when the Fed is raising interest rates, their purpose is to keep people from getting jobs. Now, again, they may well think that they have to do that to prevent inflation, but the point is that they're deliberately trying to keep people from getting jobs in order to keep inflation under control. And that's something that the media is very effectively hidden from people. I guess I will mention this. I actually remember having a conversation with a member of a regional Federal Reserve Bank, a director of a regional Federal Reserve Bank. There's 12 districts around the country. And this person was a member of one of the regional banks. And he did not understand that when they raised interest rates, they were throwing people out of work. He did not understand that. And again, I don't mean to put anything malicious on that. They think, you know, I'll give them credit for believing that's the right thing for the economy. They have to prevent inflation. But the fact that they're actually throwing people out of work is how they do that. And this person who's, you know, a well-educated person, actually one of the people implementing the policy, did not understand that. And that's no doubt because of the way it's talked about, you know, in the media and in policy circles.
Let's go back to the phone lines where we have three callers waiting patiently, and I do want to get to all of you before the program ends. Let's go now to line two. Champagne, you're on the air with Dean Baker.
Yeah, I have two questions. It's kind of a where do you draw the line question. You said something about, you know, the airline control people strike in 1980 and Reagan fired them all. And, you know, that might not be a good thing. But, I mean, at an extreme, if one person is controlling the electricity for the whole country and his job is to turn on the switch every morning, you know, and he goes on strike, then, you know, the country is just at his mercy. And in some sense, the entire economy is at the mercy of a few thousand people who want to have an airline strike. I have an air controllers strike. So is that too much power in a small group? That's one of my questions. And the other question, I appreciate a lot what you're saying about corporate welfare, et cetera. Could you talk about the corporate welfare of one of the biggest corporate welfare is a corporation right down the road in Decatur, Illinois here, Archer Daniels Midland. Could you say a few words about that, please?
All right. Thank you very much, caller.
Sure.
Dean Baker, fire away.
Well, starting with the issue of union power, I mean, you can have excessive union power, and, you know, there's ways to deal with it. I would say I don't think the U.S. was, even prior to 1980, a situation where it had excessive union power, because certainly compared to, you know, other countries in the Western world, it certainly had relatively weaker unions even prior to 1980. So, you know, I would say you can have excesses, and even the specific case, air traffic controllers, you know, you could have negotiated. There were other things that President Reagan could have done other than just firing. So, you know, that was a very, very extreme move. So I'll just leave it at that. In terms of Archer Daniels Midland, I don't know the ins and outs of everything that they do, but one certainly has reason to be suspicious of them simply because they do give so much money to political candidates. And, you know, one thing I will say has been a major push in U.S. trade negotiations has been to eliminate barriers to grain trade, which, of course, they're very, very heavily involved with, and that can have serious repercussions for developing countries, very often displacing much of their agriculture, their traditional agriculture, which can, you know, Mexico being a good example, lead to very serious problems, at least in a transition period, which could be, you know, long, 20 years, 30 years, when you look to have many people leave agriculture and hopefully find jobs in cities. That could be a very long and painful process. So I think they've played a very big role in shaping our trade agenda, which isn't necessarily for the good of people in the United States, and I think in many cases certainly not for the good of people in the developing world.
Let's go again to our phone lines now to line three, Urbana, Illinois. You're on the air with Dean Baker.
Hi. I wanted to ask you about this liquidity crisis stemming from the subprime market. When it was reported that markets were falling around the world, particularly in Asia, and it seemed to be more than just the psychological knock-on, but actually because these big funds in other countries were invested in this market in the U.S., it reminded me of the Asian financial crisis when the countries that were before, you know, the star pupils of the IMF and the World Bank, all of a sudden everyone's saying, oh, gosh, there was poor regulation here. Terrible, terrible. And I'm wondering if now there's the shoe is down the other foot, if some people in France and China are starting to say, hey, you know, maybe we should be more careful about investing in the United States because they seem to have a weak regulatory regime there. There's nobody really minding the store.
Or to add to that, if I can, caller, Dean, the whole idea that, you know, they had crony capitalism in East Asia, might that be what we have here?
I think absolutely. We have some very, very serious crony capitalism. You know, the major distinction I would actually make between this financial crisis and the East Asian financial crisis is the East Asian financial crisis was primarily one of confidence because their economies really were strong, healthy, were growing rapidly. It really was one for a variety of reasons. You just had people running to the door at the same time, whereas if you had a genuine lender of last resort, all we had was the IMF, but if you had a genuine international lender of last resort, that's exactly where you would have wanted them to step in and basically throw money at the situation because there wasn't any big underlying problems with South Korea's economy and Thailand's economy and Malaysia's economy. I might think differently of Indonesia because it's a more questionable story, but those were three of the four countries that were really hit by the East Asian financial crisis. In this case, there is really a problem. People keep talking about subprime. I try to clarify that. The problem isn't subprime. It shows up first in subprime because subprime borrowers are people with least recourse. The problem is the real estate market. And the reason why the subprime mortgages have gone bad, increasingly prime mortgages, is that prices are house prices are lower than the mortgages that people have taken out on them. You have people in the subprime market, you might be talking about a $200,000 mortgage on a 150 home that today is worth $150,000. In the larger market, you have homes where people have taken out mortgages of $600,000 or $700,000 on homes that might be worth $500,000. So we're going to see that more generally, and that's a much more difficult problem because it's not a question of confidence. The homes really are worth less than what people have lent on them. So you're going to see an awful lot of defaults. As I said, the subprime is the tip of the iceberg, and we're seeing that because these are people that have very little recourse. You know, they don't have money in the bank. They don't have, you know, a 401k that they can draw on if need be. They don't have any recourse. So those are the ones that we're going to go belly up soonest. But there's a much, much deeper problem that goes well beyond subprime. And certainly I think the Europeans and Chinese, I think they really got taken for a ride. And at the end of the day, they're probably going to be quite unhappy about the outcome of a lot of these investments.
We've only got a couple of minutes left. We have one caller from Mattoon who's been extremely patient. Let's go to line four now. Mattoon, you're on the air with Dean Baker.
Hello. Just a quick follow-up on the Chinese situation. If they call us on our debt about how it'll affect us, won't it also affect the Chinese economy, though, if they try to dissolve us?
Absolutely. I mean, this is the reason why they didn't just, you know, say, okay, we'll raise the value of our currency. They've been exporting huge amounts to the United States. Their exports have been growing very rapidly. Now, if they were to say, okay, look, we're not going to keep buying up, you know, dollars, buying up mortgage-backed securities, you know, buying up treasury bonds and supporting the dollar, we're gonna leave you on your own. We'll let the, you know, our currency will rise, your currency will fall, the two sides of the coin. Suddenly, all the goods that they've been selling to us will become much more expensive. We will buy less of them. So that will be somewhat of a hit to the Chinese economy. Now, they may actually not mind that, because if you read what they're saying, they're unhappy because their economy is growing so rapidly. Their economy has been growing, it had been growing 7 or 8 or 9%. It's been growing over 10% the last few years, and the latest data shows it growing over 11%. Just really incredible rates of growth, which much of their leadership thinks is too quick. So if you're to suddenly lose a lot of exports to the United States, well, 10 years ago they might have been very upset about that, but if their economy is growing faster than they want anyhow, losing exports to the United States would be a good thing. So they might actually decide, well, you know, we don't have to keep throwing good money after bad. We took a beating on these mortgage-backed securities. We want our economy to grow less rapidly anyhow, so we'll lose a lot of those exports to the U.S., and that will make us better off at both ends.
So the Chinese may, in fact, not be unhappy with the U.S. recession at this point, where they might have been 5 or 10 years ago.
Exactly. Again, I don't have, you know, I don't have an inside line on their thinking, but just given their public statements that they think their economy is growing too rapidly, that could fit very well with their plans.
Now, real quickly, Dean Baker, we only have a minute left, and one of the really provocative points you make in your new book, The United States Since 1980, is that the rest of the world has really caught up and is soon to surpass the United States in many respects. The idea that we're the dominant global economic power is, you know, fading quickly. And in particular, you talk about China, which you argue is really underappreciated, just how quickly it's becoming a dominant global economic power.
Yeah, there's two ways in which economists measure the size of an economy. One is an exchange rate. We just say, okay, you know, take everything they produce in China, what's that in dollars? The other way you do it is you price everything in China. It's called purchasing power parity. What would these goods and services sell for if they were sold in the United States? By that second measure, the size of China's economy is already over $11 trillion a year, which ours is about $14. So it's more than 75% as large as the U.S. economy. And if it continues to grow at 10% a year, it's going to pass the size of our economy in just a few years. And they already produce more graduates in science and technical education. They produce much more steel. They have more cell phones and, you know, computers than we do. Go down the list. So this is not an economy that's one-fifth the size of the U.S. economy. It's an economy that's very close in size to the U.S. economy.
On that note, Dean Baker, I want to thank you so much for joining us today in Media Matters. It's been a real pleasure having you here, but I hear the band tuning up in the background, which means they need to clear me out of the studio.
Well, thanks a lot for having me on. I really enjoyed it.
Sure thing. Dean Baker, the author of the brand-new book, The United States Since 1980, published by Cambridge University Press. My name's Bob McChesney. You've been listening to Media Matters on WILL AM 580. I'll be back in 167 hours with another guest, and I want to thank Andrew Boyle, as always, for being my producer. See you then.